came back to reality and learned that there were some duties. This afternoon, we're going to have a panel discussion, and the format appears, at least in the present stage of planning, that we'll have four of the select invited speakers down here at once, then we'll take a break, and then we'll put four more down here. To make things a little more lively, we hope that you'll prepare questions beforehand, even not knowing which speakers will be panelists, but prepare some questions. We've put out little post-it notes, little yellow post-it notes about every four seats. Grab one and write a short, succinct question, something that'll fit on that post-it, on the front of it. I mean, you have to ask for permission if you want to use the back of it. And then just bring them down as the questions come to you and stick them here or something like that. And we'll gather them up and try to figure out how to ask them to the panelists. So anyway, start thinking about it and then come to a clear statement and put it on the yellow post-it. And hopefully that will make this afternoon lively. Thank you.
Okay, so the first speaker this morning is Raphael Sorkin. So I have a first memory. When I came here to PI for the job interview, for the postdoc, I gave a seminar, and there was this annoying guy asking really, really sharp questions all the time. I didn't recognize who it was, and I thought, shit, I have to know who this guy is. And of course, that guy was exactly Raphael Sorkin. So he's going to give the first talk now. His central interest is in the unification of general relativity and quantum theory. He's the foremost proponent of the causal sets approach, and he's developing a reformulation and also a novel reinterpretation of quantum theory based on generalized sum over histories. Other interests include the phenomenon of topology change and the source of black hole entropy. But today he's going to focus on the very central issue and problem of time in quantum gravity.
Thanks for that introduction. And I'm afraid you might hear about 9/10 of the things that Hans mentioned in this talk. So I hope I don't overburden it with information, but it seemed a little difficult to know what to leave out. So this morning, I want to talk about time, as Hans said, in relation to the problem of quantum gravity. And more specifically, I want to talk about what's known as the problem of, or perhaps the problems, of time in quantum gravity. And in doing so, I hope to convince you that these problems largely go away, most of them go away, if the deep structure of space-time is discrete, and if one formulates quantum dynamics in the language of histories, or path integral. That's exactly what Hans referred to in his introduction. So one speaks of problems of time in quantum gravity. Perhaps the central one, or the very first one that comes to mind, is what's called the problem of the frozen formalism sometime. And it's a difficulty that arises within canonical quantum gravity specifically, where, as many of you will be familiar with, the wave function here, psi, depends on the three geometry, or in other formulations in different representations, you may not have the three geometry, you may have something different, like a set of loops or graphs, as in the Ostriker-Sen formulation. But in any case, the important thing is that among the arguments of the wave function, you don't see t. This is very different from, of course, what you're used to in the case of ordinary quantum mechanics or even quantum field theory in the Schrodinger representation, as we heard about, I think, yesterday. So since we don't have time, the problem, we have only space as an argument here. The problem is, of course, the need to recover time one way or another. It may be in the quasi-illusory form, as we heard from Julian, but in any case, you need to recover it somehow, and that's the problem of time in quantum gravity. Now, before saying a little bit more about that, I want to put in an aside about the unimodular formulation of gravity, in which this problem is to a small extent ameliorated, and in fact to a large extent if one limits oneself to a very special situation, which is spatially homogeneous cosmologies, as in the Friedman, Robertson, Walker set of cosmologies. However, so I think it's worth, and people had hopes that, some people had hopes that this would do a better job of solving the problem. So maybe it's worth briefly running through this, although it's really in the nature of an aside for this talk. In unimodular, what's called unimodular gravity, the wave function depends not only on the three geometry, but on some variable that I'll call T, which geometrically represents the four volume to the past of the hypersurface on which the wave function is being evaluated. More precisely, you can write that the variation of T between one hypersurface and another is given by the integral of the lapse over that hypersurface and multiplied by dt. So I'm using some jargon which maybe will not be familiar to everyone, but I hope it'll be familiar to most. But in any case, as I said, this is really an aside. When you do that, you get a Schrodinger equation that partial psi, partial t, and there now is a t dependence, and it's given precisely by the Hamiltonian constraint smeared with a lapse function. You might say which lapse function, but it can be any lapse function as long as its integral over the hypersurface is 1. Here I'm using what's called a densitized lapse, so I don't need a volume element in the integral. It turns out that all such, I mean, there are many such choices, but they all give an equivalent evolution law because of all the constraints that do survive in the theory, which is essentially all but one of them, and they take this form here. So in this approach, we do recover a little bit of time, but you may have heard the phrase of many-fingered time, which refers to the fact that a hypersurface can push forward independently in all its different locations. And this is just getting one finger out of an infinite number. As I said before, it's all you need for describing a Bianchi cosmology, that is a cosmology based on one of the spatial homogeneous metrics, of which the most well-known ones are the spatially homogeneous and isotropic ones, in other words, the Friedman, Robertson, Walker, the Friedman cosmos. But in that case, there's only really, the hypersurfaces are pinned down by the homogeneity, and there's only really one degree of freedom left, and you can identify that with this volume time. So you do get interesting results in quantum cosmology by using the unimodular modification. You get interesting consequences for the no boundary proposal of Hartle and Hawking. But the main thing is that you don't solve the problem of time. And so, for example, if you wanted to ask about the presence or absence of a black hole in your space-time, if there's a horizon, how big is it, where is it, how long does it last, and so on. None of those questions have an immediate translation into the formalism, because the formalism still only talks about space and one time parameter, but not really about space-time. Here I've illustrated the kind of difficulty that you could have two hypersurfaces which have the same volume to their past, but are very differently situated within the space-time. Related to this, I think there are also some troubles for the asymptotically flat context, because the volume to the past of the hypersurface would be infinite in that case. So that's really all I want to say about the modular modification or formulation of gravity. It's equivalent classically to the usual formulation. It may differ slightly quantum mechanically, and it may have important consequences for other questions, like the cosmological constant. But anyway, let's return to the main question, which is this problem of recovering time. Now that's, I would say, the most blatant and in-your-face problem of time in quantum gravity. But it's not the only one if you look at things in a certain way. Because we can ask, this problem was a consequence of, or it's equivalent to, what people call the frozen formalism. And one could ask, where did this frozen formalism come from anyway? Well, the usual answer is that it's a consequence of the diffeomorphism invariance, the coordinate independence of the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. there's different ways of understanding this relationship, but I think it's probably easiest to understand in the kind of path integral language, which I've illustrated here. So in the path integral, you start, as most people think of it, you start with a wave function on some initial hypersurface, sigma naught, and then propagate it forward via some interpolating four-manifold M to a final hypersurface, which is supposed to be orange here. I don't think the colors come out too brilliantly, but I hope you can see them. So this final hypersurface sigma is orange, and that gives you the wave function. If you fix the three geometry on sigma and then do the sum over all interpolating four manifolds of the amplitude e to the is, you get a number, and that's the value of the wave function at that three geometry. That's in the context of evolution from one hypersurface to another. Probably a more fundamental context is the cosmological one, in which instead of having an initial wave function, you have something like a cosmological boundary condition. And so I've, for example, here expansion from a point I've indicated. But you still have a final hypersurface, and you can still compute a wave function for it using the same formula. In that formulation, which is just the usual formulation of gravity as if it were any other field theory, the hypersurface has a certain location in space-time given by its coordinates, say a t equals constant in some coordinate system. And the function of the Hamiltonian, this is familiar from path integrals in general, the function of the Hamiltonian is to move that hypersurface around. In other words, to tell you how the wave function changes when you move the hypersurface. Since in this case the hypersurface is infinitely flexible, there's an infinite number of Hamiltonians, and they're known as the Hamiltonian constraints, one for each point in the hypersurface. The Hamiltonian itself, if you want to call it that, is the smearing, something like this expression here, the smearing with an appropriate lapse function that tells you how far forward you want to push the hypersurface at any given point. But, of course, general relativity is coordinate independent. So if we change the t coordinate of the final hypersurface, we've really done nothing. We do the integral, and if we believe that the so-called measure factor is invariant under coordinate change too, when we do the integral, we get exactly the same answer. The wave function psi really can't depend on where the final hypersurface is in coordinate language, and therefore the Hamiltonian, which evolves it from one place to another, must vanish. And the Schrodinger equation gets replaced by a constraint that just says h hat acting on psi is zero. That's this problem of time, or this frozen formalism. Refer back to the other aside on unimodular gravity, you might ask how this story goes in that context. In that context, you do exactly the same path integral, only you fix the volume of the interpolating manifold, m in either case. That gives you one parameter on which the wave function can depend, and that functions as a time, what I called capital T in the previous slide. And you get a real Schrodinger equation, but you don't solve the problem of time. It's an invariant definition because volume is a geometrical quantity. It has nothing to do with the coordinates, space-time volume. But it still leaves most of the slicing freedom. So this frozen formalism comes from diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. And in that more general sense, we can say that anything problem, conceptual or technical, that springs from diffeomorphism invariance can be regarded as a problem of time. So then, if I take that point of view, I can identify several other independent problems of time. Let me start with what I've called the second problem of time, which is problems of principle coming from diffeomorphism invariance. Of course, the distinction between problems of principle and problems of technical problems is notoriously loose or slippery, and in any given case, you don't really know which is which, but I think there's some which are fairly clearly more of the nature of problems of principle or conceptual problems, and others which are more of the nature of technical problems. So let's start with problem of principle, I think the prime one, which is closely related to the frozen formalism issue, and that is how can we find within the formalism observables that are consistent with general covariance, that are free of coordinates? Here I've used a more neutral word, variables, and then you can read that as observables, or if you prefer, I think I prefer to read them as beables. But the important thing is, how can we find quantities associated with the theory that lead to questions that we can ask that have a physical meaning and that the theory can provide an answer for? For example, suppose you asked, as you could in any other field theory, you could ask for the expectation value of the field at a given point. Well, if you ask for the expectation value of the metric component G03 at the points t equals 1, x equals 2, y equals blah, 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 of course, that has no meaning because it's purely gauge. It's purely dependent on the choice of coordinates. What you have to, the kind of things that do have meaning are much more difficult to formulate. And this is what I mean by the problem of finding observables that are covariant. That's already not so easy in some formulations. But beyond that, there's, I think, an even more important problem is, even if you found them, how do you recognize their physical meaning? I mean, you might have found them mathematically, but how do you know how to interpret them physically? And vice versa, if you have a physical question in mind, like about a black hole horizon, for example, how do you identify which of these observables poses that question? So if we look at this, for example, in quantum gravity, canonical quantum gravity, sorry, then the usual, it's treated like a gauge theory normally, and the constraints generate, in some sense, gauge transformations, diffeomorphisms, although it's a little subtle whether you can say that literally. But we saw how there's a certain constraint, Hamiltonian constraint, is related to diffeomorphism invariance. And normally one says that the observable operators, or the physical operators, as people usually say, must commute. This is a symbol for commute. But the observable operators must commute with the constraints. That means, of course, when the constraint is the Hamiltonian, that they must be, in some sense, time independent. So it's the same frozen formalism coming back again at the level of observables. Now, in any particular formulation of canonical quantum gravity, you can say loop quantum gravity, one can find many, perhaps anyway, let's be generous and say you can find many such observables. But what you can't do is, except with very small exceptions, say what these observables mean. In an asymptotically flat context, you may have things like the total energy or angular momentum. But if you're in a cosmological constant, it's hard to come up with even one observable where you can really say what it means. In fact, if you have what people call the physical Hilbert space, the set of solutions of the constraints, then any operator in that Hilbert space is in some sense an observable. But again, what does it mean? And how would I identify which operator is talking about the presence or absence of a black hole horizon? Because in canonical gravity, the operators are formed from initial data, which means a three metric and a kind of time derivative of the three metric or extrinsic curvature, it doesn't tell you about the whole space-time. To get that information, you'd have to do something as difficult as solving the operator Einstein equations. And that's obviously pretty much out of the question. That's where something that you might call a technical problem becomes really, I think, a problem of principle. So that was the second problem of time. The third one, coming from diffeomorphism variance, the third one, so the third class, is some problems of time flowing, which are technical and flow from diffeomorphism invariance. So let me just mention two. In the context of the path integral for quantum gravity, you know, the path integral is the integral of e to the is, where s is the classical action. But whenever you do an integral, there's the question of the weight with which you take the contributions to the integrand. In other words, there's a question of what is what people call the measure factor, or sometimes just the measure in the path integral. This is very difficult in a theory with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, like quantum gravity or any field theory. And it's even more difficult when there's gauge involved and when that gauge group is non-compact. In flat space field theories, there's a procedure called the Fedayeff-Popov procedure for dealing with this. It becomes much more difficult when the diffeomorphism group is non-compact, as it is in the case of relative, I mean, when the gauge group is non-compact, as it is in the case of the diffeomorphism group. In the canonical formulation, there's a similar question, which is, what is the inner product? If you suppose you've even found all the solutions of the constraint, that is all the wave function psi of g, which satisfy all the constraints, you still want to be able to take their inner product and form expectation values and so on. And to take the inner product is to integrate psi 1, psi 2 star over the 3 manifold. What weight factor, sorry, over the space of, integrate psi 1, psi 2 star over the space of 3 metrics. And the question is, with what weights the different metrics enter? So that's the more or less equivalent problem in the canonical formulation. So these technical problems which flow, which are really in essentially, I think, ultraviolet problems, they come from the infinite number of degrees of freedom. They also can be seen as problems of time. So to complete the list of these problems, let me mention three more, making a total of 6. And let's start with, here they are. There's not as much to be said about each one of these. They're more, I think, self-explanatory. The fourth one I've called is the absence of a Wick rotation. Now, whether this is really a problem and whether it's really a problem of time, I suppose, could be questioned. There's nothing that we know of in nature that requires the existence of Wick rotation. Wick rotation here means the ability to replace t by it in the formalism, and then analytically continue back. And it's a key technical tool that's used in quantum field theories. But it doesn't, except for a few people, like, for example, I think Paul Yerkes and Stephen Hawking, seem to think that it has a much deeper significance, that somehow the world is really of a Euclidean signature or something. But most people would view it just as a technical advice. However, a device. However, it's very significant at a practical level that you don't have it, apparently, in quantum gravity. You don't have it in gravity. You can't analytically continue any solution to the Einstein equations and get a Euclidean solution. And you could see it as a problem of time, because in a sense, if you had a unique time coordinate, it would be much easier to know how to do the analytic continuation, the complexification of that time. Indeed, something rather like that is what happens in the causal dynamical triangulation approach. The fifth problem of time, now this is heading back towards the things that are perhaps more in the spirit of this conference as a whole, is the problem, it's a big jump from a technical problem to a very conceptual, not even entirely well-posed problem of what in philosophy could be called the problem of becoming. In colloquial language, this is the question of, do things happen? Do things really happen? Or is the lesson of relativity that we live in some sort of timeless, tenseless, four-dimensional reality that's just there, and our impression of change is just some sort of psychological problem we have, or some illusion, something like that. This is also related to diffeomorphism invariance, because many people have argued that the only way to have a now, have things really happen, is to have a now which is identified with a three-dimensional slice through the four-dimensional space-time. But of course, diffeomorphism invariance forbids a unique slicing. There is no distinguished way of choosing the time coordinates. And then finally, number 6 here is not, I think, really a problem of quantum gravity. It's the problem of the arrow of time. It long predates quantum gravity. And it's not an extra problem that quantum gravity has to cope with, but it's perhaps an opportunity. One could certainly hope that quantum gravity will teach us something important new about time, and in that way it'll help us to answer the questions about the arrow. So how do these, as I said before in the introduction, what I hope to convince you is that most of these problems go away if we adopt a history's formulation of quantum mechanics and if the deep structure of space-time is discrete. So more generally, I wanted to try to claim that the way that these problems appear is very much tied to how you do formulate quantum mechanics. So we should step back and ask, in thinking about these problems, what is a quantum theory anyway? When we're doing quantum gravity, it's not as straightforward. Keep in mind, maybe as a paradigm, quantum field theory, because that's closer to quantum gravity than quantum mechanics is, particle mechanics. So there are, of course, an innumerable number of variations on how you can define a quantum theory, especially when it comes to interpretations. But I think maybe there are roughly three broad strains in the approaches, different ways of thinking about quantum theory, which I've called the canonical, the path integral, and for lack of a better word, the algebraic or quantum field theory-like approach. The canonical approach is perhaps the most familiar, especially in textbooks. You identify a pair of canonically conjugate variables, Q and P, which in case of gravity is actually the three metric and its time derivative. You impose the Heisenberg commutation relations, and you have identify a Hamiltonian which you can use to evolve the wave function and write down the Schrodinger equation. So quantum mechanics in this formulation appears as a generalized form of Hamiltonian mechanics, which is probably the way most people still think of it. The second formulation is rather different, the path integral formulation. In that, the central object is not the operators, not the Hamiltonian, not any commutation relations, but just an integral of e to the is, at least formally, where s is the classical action, so that's sort of the central mathematical object, together with a measure factor. So gamma here represents whatever you're integrating over. In the case of quantum gravity, that would be the space-time metric, or the equivalence class of space-time metrics up to diffeomorphism, what's called the Ford geometry. Viewed in this way, quantum mechanics appears as a generalized theory of stochastic processes. In other words, it's a generalized theory of probability, which is, I think, a point of view that you could find fairly clearly expressed already in very early writings of Heisenberg and, of course, in Feynman's writing about the path integral. The third set of approaches, which I don't have a good name for, and corresponding to that, I'm not sure quite how to think about it. I think to some extent it's not really distinct from the other two taken together, but there's a third approach, especially in the context of the community of quantum gravity. It used to be called the covariant approach to quantum gravity. And this is to treat gravity just as you would treat any other field in space-time and try to do a field theory of it in the same way as you do, say, for the electromagnetic field or the gluon field or something. So in this, the central object is the variable GAB, but now regarded as a function of x, not of just of some t, but of x being a space-time point. And you promote it to a set of operators GAB of x. The fundamental sort of mathematical description of the dynamics will be then the operator Einstein equations, if you can give them a good meaning. And you still need, however, so they replace the Hamiltonian in a sense, but you still need some way of putting in the commutation relations, but perhaps there's a way called, based on what's called Pyrrho's bracket, of doing that in a more covariant form than it is in the equal time commutation form. So just as I'm not quite sure how to think of, how to name this, I'm not quite sure what it's trying to tell us, but perhaps we can say it's more akin to an operationalist attitude towards quantum mechanics, because we can perhaps think of these operators as representing kinds of experiments or observations we could do on the gravitational field. In any case, I won't be talking too much about this approach, because essentially, I'm not really aware of anyone who's, well, that's not quite true. The I'm aware of no one who's directly pursuing this, although the one approach that has aspects of it, this so-called asymptotic freedom approach. So looking at these three different ways of thinking about or defining a quantum theory, I have the feeling like Goldilocks, for those of you who, I suppose most people know this fairy tale, although I'm not sure it's all children learn it everywhere in the world. But Goldilocks, if you don't know, you could, it was somewhere about a bear. The thing is that she found some soup on the table, or I think it was. Or porridge, was it? Porridge, yes. Yeah, I never knew what was porridge until I got to England. But yeah, she found some porridge, and one of them was too hot, one was too cold, one was just right, and so on. So there was a bed, and I don't know. All. It's always one too big, one too small, just right. So I have that feeling about these approaches to quantum gravity in relation to time. I think approach one, the canonical approach, has too little time. That's the problem of recovering time that we saw before. Approach number three has too much because it gives you the whole space-time, it gives you all the coordinates, and in particular, it forbids the topology from changing. It's built in. Okay? I think for that reason, Bryce DeWitt, who was the main proponent of this kind of approach, thought that you couldn't have topology change because by definition, you had to do quantum mechanics this way, and it forbids topology change. But to many of us, that's a real weakness in this approach. So even though it has a lot of time, that it is all these space-time coordinates, they're all gauged, so in a sense they're not there, but nevertheless they forbid things like topology change. So I'll call that too much. The path integral approach then is the porridge that was just right. It has time because it refers to space-time, but it gives full dynamical freedom to the space-time manifold. So what I want to do now is, rest of the talk is concentrate on these path integral approaches, or what I'll call sum over histories approaches to quantum gravity. I've already critiqued the canonical approach and a little bit of the algebraic approach. I want to concentrate on sum over histories approach, first taking them in the continuum setting and then going to the discrete setting, which I hope you'll see helps to clear away a large fraction of the problems that remain even in the continuum setting. So let's start with what I call sum over histories quantum gravity in the continuum version. Some examples, to name some examples of approaches that follow this path. One is causal dynamical triangulation, which although it's discrete in its formulation, its intent is to be continuous, that they have a cutoff. They have an element of discreteness, but they view it as just a cutoff, a regularization, and they want to take the continuum limit in which the cutoff size goes to zero. Also, asymptotic safety. I put a question mark here because it might go to some extent in the algebraic approach, too. That's what I was referring to before. That I won't say, unless someone asks, exactly what is this approach. But it's another continuum approach that I'll class with the path integral approaches. I suppose, in a certain way, spin foams could also go here. They are genuinely discrete. Sometimes they're thought of as part of canonical quantum gravity, but they actually have an independent existence, and to some extent may be contradictory to it. So what about the problems of time? So now I hope, are these things visible, legible across the top? I tried to list, just to keep in mind what these problems of time were, but it looks pretty small from here. Which row are you? In the third row, yeah. Can anyone in back? Yeah, okay, good. So what about these problems of time? With respect to continuum path integral approach to gravity. The very first problem of recovering time, well, nothing needs to be said. It's not there. We have space-time. That's what the path integral is based on. So there's nothing to recover. So I said I had really too much material for this lecture, but in a sense, I could just stop here. That's the main moral, I think, is that in a path integral approach, there is no problem of time. At least there's no problem, I mean, but that's a little too cheap to say that. There's no problem of recovering time, but some of the other problems that are recognizably problems of time are not so trivial to deal with. So I can't really stop. Let me go on to the others. The second problem of time, which was the problem of identifying observables, well, it's better here because now we have space-time. So if we want to ask about, for example, the presence and size of a horizon, at least we know how to give that meaning. We know how to start. And so I think you can say that even without discreteness, this second problem of time is very much better. Perhaps it's even fully soluble. One can define, in a certain sense, many observables. Whether it's full complement or enough in the sense that I'll talk about later is not clear, but it's certainly the situation is improved. If you're interested in a sort of cute illustration of how some of these ideas work out in the case of black hole entropy, I refer you just for fun to a paper that I wrote with Danielle Sudarsky on large fluctuations in the entropy. It addresses some related issues and illustrates how the path integral might be able to pose things in a way that you just don't have a handle on in the canonical formulation. What about the third problem of time, the technical ones? Well, here, again, there's some good ideas, like what's called dynamical triangulations is a particular choice, in effect, of the measure factor. It's telling you what weight you should include the different four geometries with in the sum over history. So I think we can say progress, still not a definitive solution. However, in a sense, I lied, or I should have made a caveat, or I think in this country it may be caveat. Did anyone happen to see these hearings on Maher Arar a few years ago? I don't know if anyone saw it. I noticed that these people are always saying caveat instead of caveat. The intelligence agencies, when they send information to another one, they include caveats with it. Anyway, so I have to make a big caveat or caveat in saying that path integral solves these problems. The reason is that the answer of the path integral to the question I posed before of what is a quantum theory is not complete. We have a technical expression, a mathematical expression that we can write down, but we don't know how to interpret it fully. We don't fully know how to interpret it without referring back to the other ideas that go with the canonical formulation. In other words, we lack what I'm calling a freestanding path integral theory. Usually when people deal with a path integral, they write it something like this, like the picture I had with two hypersurfaces. Like this picture here, they have an initial hypersurface, a final hypersurface, a wave function as input on the initial hypersurface, and a wave function as output. So in other words, they're doing, with fixed boundary conditions on the two surfaces, a path integral, and all you get, well, you think of what you get as a propagator for the wave function. And since you've thought of it that way, you still have to base the interpretation ultimately on the wave function. That lands you back with all the, you know, all the problems that we started with, frozen formalism, and so on. What we really need, I claim, is to free the path integral from its dependence on psi, that its conceptual dependence on the wave function. Now, fortunately, we have the formalism we need for this to a large extent. It goes by the name of decoherence functional, which is used in the decoherent histories interpretation, but should be distinguished as just a mathematical object. The decoherence functional, it also goes by the name of Schwinger-Keldysh formalism in the context of thermal field theory, essentially the same idea. So we have to some extent, I think, the right mathematical object to represent the path integral without reference to wave functions. Another language for this is quantum measure theory. This is thinking of it as giving a generalized probability to sets of histories, what I referred to before, thinking of the path integral as defining a generalized probability theory. So some of it is there, but in the interpretational level, we still quite don't know how to think about it. And I would say that the question that we don't have the answer to is, what is a quantum reality? We need to answer that, and to do so without presupposing a background causal structure, which only makes life more difficult. There's an attempt that's grown out of causal set program, which I called here anhomomorphic coevents, and I think Hans referred to it briefly in the introduction, but I really don't have too much more to say about it, or time to talk about it here. But I do want to mention a question that I think can be profitably thought about, that I wish more people would think about. I'm not sure I've quite set up the technical background to say this question clearly, but I would still want to try to say it because I think it's so important and so neglected, which is, what is the decoherence functional for gravity, even in the continuum and even formally? So I haven't defined a decoherence functional. You can think of it, perhaps, as just an amplitude, just as you think of the path integral as an amplitude associated to a history. The decoherence functional is an amplitude associated to pairs of histories. And from it, the quantum measure is made. But if you're familiar with what that means, then the question I'm asking is, given two pairs of truncated four geometries, or two sets of four geometries, what amplitude do I get from putting in the decoherence function? Or how do I express that as a path integral? The answer that most people probably would give, which is just the direct analog of the one that you're used to in field theory, I think is not tenable when one thinks carefully about the classical limit. So I'm sorry if that sounds all very mysterious, but I can later on make it more clear if there's a little more time or in discussion. Anyway, I just want to raise that question, but I now want to devote the rest of the talk to the other problems of time that remain. And I want to bring in discreteness and address these problems in the context of this particular discrete theory, which is that of causal sets. How many pages? Okay. So causal sets, of course, are a theory of a discrete space-time structure, or a theory of a discrete structure that's meant to form the substratum of space-time, which in popular language is emergent from this other structure. It might have been better to do a little more introduction to them. As I said, I tried to pack a little too much into this talk, so let me just skim some of the high points and assume that the basic idea might be a little familiar to you. What a causal set is a partial order, that is a set of elements which you could think of as atoms of space-time, not of space, but of space-time, so they don't persist in time. Atoms of space-time which are endowed with an order relation, a microscopic order relation that corresponds to the macroscopic relation of before and after, or temporal relation. Or, as we'll see in a second, it's natural to call it an ancestral relation of being a descendant or an ancestor, a parent or a child. And in that sense, it's natural to use, describe the causal set as a kind of generalized family tree. I'll draw some pictures of some in a second. So I'll show you some pictures. It's an important thing is that it's discrete. In any volume of space-time, there are only a finite number of elements. But that's a bad way of saying it. Not in any volume of space-time. The causal sets aren't in anything. They are space-time. So a better way of saying it is that what we perceive as in the emergent theory, in the effective theory, is that a volume of space-time is composed of a finite number of causal set elements. And in fact, the volume is exactly the number of elements. If this theory is right, let me just say, thinking this way, taking the order relation as primary, carries on a long tradition of causality that's in relativity theory and goes back to the very earliest days of relativity theory, if not before. In other words, we see the causal structure of space-time, not the metric, not its topology, not its differentiable structure, certainly, as the most basic element and the one that survives in the deeper theory. taking that order relationship and putting it together with the discreteness, which allows you to count, you get geometric information because, for example, lengths of curves can just be numbers of elements. This is a point made by Riemann long ago. So geometry is then an emergent property, and it emerges in a way captured by the slogan, order plus number equals geometry. If this is correct, then it explains why there is a metric, which you might not have asked yourself that question, but it's an interesting one to ask. Why should there be anything like a metric at all? Why should there be distance, especially if you like conformal structures like we were hearing in a couple of talks recently? Why should there be a notion of length? Well, the answer is the discreteness. There's numbers you can count, and by counting, you get length. Not only that, it doesn't, of course, explain to you why you get a pseudo-Riemannian metric, but it does tell you, I mean, it doesn't tell you why the geometry is described by a metric tensor, but it does tell you that if it is to be described by that, it must have the Lorentzian signature and no other, because only the Lorentzian signature has a well-defined causal order associated with it. Only for the Lorentzian signature do the light cones fall into two disconnected parts, one of which you can call the future half and the other the past. So that's all kinematical description of what a causal set is meant to be. Of course, it has to have a dynamics as well, and the one that's emerged out of in recent years is the dynamics of sequential growth, in which we think the dynamic is not described in something like sort of discrete Einstein equation, but it's described by a process. This is in line with the idea of causal set theory as a stochastic theory. It's a growth process. The elements are born one by one, and as they're born with a particular set of ancestors, and so that process builds up a pattern of relationships that is the causal set. It is the partial order. By the way, I've taken it to be past finite for convenience here. That means each element should have only a finite number of ancestors. So we're assuming, in effect, that there's a real beginning to things. So this is the idea for a dynamics. It turns out that this can be developed very far and rather uniquely in the classical setting, which I mean there's randomness, but no quantum randomness, no interference. There's no interference, but there is randomness. To really have quantum gravity, we would need what we still lack, which is a quantum sequential growth dynamics. But we do have a classical sequential growth dynamics. And it partly reproduces manifolds, but not fully. It reproduces them enough that you can get interesting insights into, for example, how there might be a cyclic cosmology, why we might get homogeneity and isotropy. But for this talk, the most important fact is that this classical sequential growth dynamics can serve as a laboratory for studying the problems of time. And in a way that I think it's very likely the answers that come out are very likely to go over to the quantum dynamics when we have it. So that's what I want to do for the remainder of this talk is use this laboratory to address some of the problems of time that still remain in my list. So let me first describe a little bit about, more in detail, what is this classical sequential growth dynamics. So here's a poset. This is also a poset, a partially ordered set. But it's not the causal set. It's a poset made of causal sets. So we take here all finite causal sets and put them together in a way that illustrates which ones could arise from which other ones by a birth of a causal set element. So for example, let's start with the empty set in the very beginning. And one element is born. That's this, you get, just if you can see it, you get a causal set of one element, which is, of course, unique. But at the next stage already, there are two possibilities. The second element can be born following this path as the child of the first, and you get what's called a two-chain. Or it could be born this way, unrelated to the first, called an anti-chain. And so on. The third, if this is what happened at the second stage, then at the third stage, you have two possibilities, either a three-chain, which is like a parent, a child, and a grandchild, or this V here, which is like perhaps a parent and two siblings, or this L, let's call it, this other causal set, and so on. And as time goes on, that is, as the number of causal set elements grows, the pattern becomes much more complex, unbelievably complex, and you get far more possibilities. But in general, this process of stochastic classical growth is just a path, an upward path through this diagram here, the poset of finite causal sets. So that's the sense in which we're talking about just a traditional mathematical stochastic process. That still leaves a huge range of possibilities, of course, but there are what we call the CSG, classical stochastic growth models, drastically narrows that down by imposing two principles. One is general covariance in a discrete form, which means label invariance. That's the one I'll stress because that's the one related to the problem of time and diffeomorphism invariance. And there's a causality condition, which I'll say very little about, which is we call Bell causality. Taken together, those two principles lead to a unique family of classical sequential growth models, that is a classical dynamics for causal sets of a random walk type. So it's a random walk through a postcal is the nickname for the postset of finite causal sets. So that's what I showed you, the diagram that you just saw. The whole process is defined like any stochastic process by transition probabilities, like just as a random walk is, what's the probability of moving to the right or the left of each step. They're more complicated, of course. Here's an example of a transition. So the black dots represent the causal set as it already is at some stage of the growth. The red is a possible new birth, and we want the probability of that particular birth as opposed to any other new birth. And here, in the case of what's called transitive percolation, it's a very simple number. It's characterized by one parameter p, and it's just p squared times 1 minus p. That's sort of the important special case of this CSG models. In the general case, just to show you the nature, how the formula looks, get a sense of it, the probability is more complicated. It's given in terms of two parameters, this pi, this astrophysicist's pi, which represents the total number of ancestors, in this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, and M, which is the total number of parents, are maximal immediate ancestors, maximal elements among the ancestors, which in this case is just 1, 2. And you plug it into this formula, which is given in terms of the coupling constants or parameters of the theory, T sub L, by this sum over binomial coefficients. Anyway, that gives you maybe just a feeling for what the dynamics looks like. The important thing for this talk is the meaning of general covariance. Now, in building up this, the causal set by this process of growth, following a path through this, obviously the elements were born in a certain order. Like in this, if I get the two chain here, the element of the past is born before the element of the future. Well, that has to be because otherwise the time of the birth would not be compatible with the inherent time, which is the physical time defined by the causal set. But in other cases, it's not clear which element is born first. Like if we had gone here, for example, there's two ways to get here, and that corresponds to two different orders of birth, or even three, if you count a certain way. So let's look at that. We don't want that to figure into the physics, or else we've introduced a distinguished labeling, which is like a distinguished foliation or a distinguished coordinate system in the continuum. So let's suppose at this at some stage we built up this causal set. Then suppose it happened as I showed on the left branch of that diagram. Then this element would have to be born first. Oh, no, sorry, this is the right branch. This element would have been born second. And then the third element has got to be the one on the top. On the other hand, on the left branch, this element would have been born first again. But the second would have been this one, and the third would be this. Now, these two differ by exchange of the blue and green circles. And those are two elements that are space-like to each other. There's no causal relation in here. I should have said that these lines represent causal relationships, just like in any space-time diagram. So it shouldn't have any physical meaning, which, whether this was born first or this was born first. And that's a constraint. It says, in the end, it says that the probability of producing this causal set is independent of that choice. We can call that label invariance. If you express it in terms of the paths in that diagram, it's really path independence. And if we express it in the language of stochastic processes, it's the Markovian condition. It says that the process is the Markov product process, which is very fortunate in what makes it possible to get a complete solution of the conditions leading of Bell causality and general covariance or label invariance. So label invariance, so covariance is the main thing. We have here a stochastic process with back, completely background independence and also generally covariant, but of course still classical. So in that context, let me now go to the final three problems of time. Four problems, the technical problems, I won't really talk about the Wick rotation, this doesn't add anything, so three more. Problem of becoming and the problem of the arrow of time. So I claim that to a greater or lesser extent, these are solved. Now why, for classical, by classical sequential growth and by implication by quantum sequential growth, how does it solve the third problem of time, which is the problem of making sense of integrals in infinite dimensional spaces and so on? Well, that's, there's nothing to it, right? That's why we made it discrete in the first place. We don't have an integral anymore. We just have a sum, a literal sum over histories, a sum over causal sets, or in that particular imagery, a sum over paths in that postcal. This is slightly oversimplifying the real story, because at any finite stage, you have a finite sum, but really general covariance requires you to think of the infinite limit in which the growth goes to completion. You actually have an infrared infinity, which in a Lorentzian context is not that totally distinct from an ultraviolet infinity. But that problem can also be solved just using the standard tools of measure theory or probability theory. And so you have a completely well-defined measure on the space of classical, on the space of causal sets, completed causal sets. Okay, so that's solved in a more or less straightforward way, just realizing the potential of discreteness. What about the problem of the arrow of time? Is that solved? Well, it's not clear, maybe, but in a sense, it just says that the problem is not even one that you can state anymore, because the whole way this is set up has a direction of time built into it. The causal set is growing, not shrinking, or the elements are being born and not dying. So an arrow, the problem, of course, turns around. Why do we get even some approximate time reversal invariance? There's another thing that I can say beyond that, which is that some of these models, although in their formulation they look time asymmetric, very much so, they have a kind of local time symmetry for large regions of the universe, or the causal set. The particular one called percolation has that feature. So it does actually have a kind of time reversal invariance. But the vast majority of the models don't have even that. And they're just very frankly time reversal non-invariant. So that's problem six. And then let me finish with problems two. Oops, I'm running out of time. So let me finish with problem the one that I wanted to concentrate on was problems two and problem five. That is the problem of observables, covariant observables, and the problem of becoming. So as far as the covariant observables, this requires a little technology. So let me just try and give you the flavor so not to overrun the time. A theory of stochastic processes is defined in terms of a history space and an event algebra, or what you might call the algebra of observables. The history space, which I've called here omega, is the set of all the histories, that is the set of all the causal sets that could grow. And I put a tilde to show that in the first instance, we're talking about labeled causal sets as they come out of the mathematics of the growth process. Going along with that is the event algebra, which is just the set of all questions you might ask about the causal set. Does it have a big bang in the sense of a unique element from which all the others descend, or does it have two elements at the bottom? Any question you could ask about the causal set. That gives you an algebra of observables or an event algebra using the language of probability theory, which fortunately is also the language of physics. So an event really is just a set of histories, set of causal sets in which that event happens. But these are with labels. What general covariance does is it tells us that really we should be talking about equivalence classes of labeled causal sets. That is, we should erase the labels. That's the real physical thing. And correspondingly, we should be talking about, that's a quotient. Correspondingly, we should be talking about a sub-algebra of questions, those which don't refer to the labels. It's this that has the physical meaning. And now, when I say, or I will now say, that I think that this problem of observables is solved in the causal set in the context of the CSG models, when I say that, it's because we can identify a set of observables or events, which are called stem events. They have a clear physical meaning on one hand. On the other hand, every question can be generated from them by logical combinations of using and, or, and not. So I think I won't quite tell the whole story for lack of time, but let me just quote the theorem. The stem events, S, there's an event such a stem event S for every stem S generates the full algebra of events modulo sets of measure zero. That is, if you ignore things which have probability zero to happen. Here I've illustrated what is a stem. It's the analog of what you might call a past set. Here's some causal set. What's called the Hasse diagram of the causal set, or the space-time diagram. And these things that I've highlighted in yellow or orange are a stem because they contain, for every element that they contain all its ancestors. That's what a stem is, a finite sub-causal set that has that property. So what you're really asking is, in the process of growth, does this stem grow or not? If you ask that for all possible stems and make all possible logical combinations, you get zero, okay. You get all possible meaningful covariant questions you can ask. Just remark that you could do the same for the continuum, maybe, but it's not so easy to see, to feel convinced by it. Also remark that since this resolution of the problem is really primarily the kinematic level, it has only a small reference to the dynamics, hopefully it will go over for quantum gravity as well. So let me now, finish with the last one. The problem of becoming. Well, I would offer that we have here a model that has becoming because it's a birth process. The whole thing is very dynamical. It has a birth of elements are born. That's in some sense the now. The causal set that's built up is in some sense the past. So it's rather like what when one talk was calling a growing block universe. And yet, it respects general covariance in a completely well-defined sense. There's no unique slicing. And why is that? Well, if you took a God's eye, if you imagine yourself as God, then you would look and see the growth process, and at each stage there'd be a particular causal set. But no one is God. We're embedded in the causal set ourselves, and we don't see it that way. And I think the problem is coming from trying to imagine that you could see it that way. If you see it, try and see it from inside, then you still have becoming, but an element may be born here and over there some other element, and it's just not meaningful to say which one is born first or whether they're born at the same time. So it's just something you have to try and muddle through imprint on your mind somehow. And if you can do it successfully, I think that solves the problem. And maybe a little help for doing that successfully is to give it a catchy name. So let me propose the word asynchronous becoming for that idea. Thanks.
Okay, time for questions. Yes, Lev.
You had these three options, and then you said that the two is just right. And but when you analyze two, it seems that you admitted that it doesn't have really interpretation. You didn't. In one moment you said, this was much later, and you worked in this framework that there is some kind of well-defined physical event. But in all this list, there is no any recipe of corresponding between this history approach and to explain our experience. So it's.
Well, I
admit. And maybe just okay. It's this maybe somewhat connected. I still. And you are trying to solve these problems. One of them to define observables, which I don't understand why it's important. You have to explain our experience. Observables not necessarily helpful for this becoming. It's not clear that if there is something, some becoming, or there is no. I don't see any observable. Can we sense if there is becoming or there is no becoming? Is this a problem? Do we have to solve this problem?
Yeah, so I did say, I think when I introduced that problem, that it's not as clear that it is a problem or exactly what it means. But I think to many of us, it does have a meaning. But I think the more objective thing I could say is that it has a meaning in the context of building new theories. If we were just stuck with the theory that we had the theory of everything, we could argue forever about whether it has becoming in it or not. But if we're trying to build a new theory, there is some sort of practical difference. If you believe in this becoming, you'll be led to something more like the growth model that I described. And if you believe in the other theory, you'll be led to something more like equations that are just imposed on the causal set without reference. So I don't want to argue that. It's just for those who think it is a problem, I think that this is an interesting sort of answer. As far as whether there's an interpretation for the path integral, I did say there's not a complete interpretation, but I didn't want to say that we don't have any interpretation. I think it's our task to finish the interpretation, and I think that is to give a freestanding path integral theory that doesn't rely on the notions of wave function. And I think one can say that we've gone along a significant ways towards that, but I don't want to claim that the process is complete. I just didn't have time to talk about the interpretive questions, but I didn't want to give the impression that they're just an open, blank sheet.
Well, that was exactly my question. I really liked it when you said that we have to free the path integral from the wave function. I just wanted to try to clarify a little more about what you meant. I saw you say that this division of the full hypersurface into two halves was a little bit arbitrary, and was what you were trying to say was instead of associating our fundamental quantum state with half of that boundary, then maybe we should try to extend our quantum state to the whole boundary? Is that what you were trying to say?
Or? No, that really wasn't. It's almost the opposite. I was trying to say we shouldn't worry about the boundary at all. We should worry about, if we think in the continuum, we should worry about the space-time as a whole and its properties. And the wave function lives on the boundary, but the amplitude lives in the whole space-time. So
I have to apologize for the rest of you have questions. I think we're already 12 minutes over time.
It's my fault, pardon.
Yeah. So I think we keep those for the coffee break. So thank the speaker again.